All right, I think we are all here. It's 7. I like to take advantage of people's time. Stephanie, I'm so sorry I did not answer you back this afternoon. You can talk for half an hour, you can talk for an hour and a half,
Okay.
whatever works for you. Sometimes we usually people want to talk till about 7 for about an hour and a half,
Okay.
but often whoever's my speaker is like, "Oh, I gotta go help my kid with their homework or whatever." And when then we just talk. We don't care.
Okay. All right.
We
Sounds good.
love anything you give us.
Okay.
Oh,
Okay.
so everyone, this is Stephanie Jurstad. I actually found Stephanie because I had just attended a conference virtually. It was in Philadelphia or in somewhere in
Ohio.
Philadelphia. The thing that starts with P and it's like this.
Oh, parcel. Was it in
Pennsylvania.
parcel?
Pennsylvania. I attended this conference and when they were sending out like their list of all the people that were coming, they sent out a person who is clearly like reading my mind because I just take calls more and more and more. I get calls from people saying, you know, my partner and I are living in our car in a parking lot at the, you know, whatever, or, you know, my landlord just kicked me out. So many people that I've talked to lately are dealing with homelessness. And Stephanie is an academic who has chosen to study and learn more about how people on the registry end up homeless. And also the other thing that's bit like been on my mind that I've been just sort of worrying about in my own head, but I didn't know anyone else was worrying about is nursing homes saying no to people on the registry. So it's like, well, I guess they're literally planning for us to live in tents in, you know, the shitty area of the city. It's very scary. Anyway, I digress. Stephanie, Dr. Jurstad is a professor of criminology at Millersville University. Her research focuses on corrections, re-entry barriers, instability. Sorry. Okay, I'm going to just quit because it's hiding. Sorry about that, Stephanie. I'm going to just
Okay.
leave.
Yeah, that's okay. Hello, everybody. I'm so happy to be here, and thanks, Anne, for asking me to come and speak tonight. Am I able to like share my screen?
You should be able to
Okay.
all participants. Okay, yeah, now you can.
Okay, let's see here. I do have a PowerPoint presentation that I thought I could just use as we're having conversations and talking tonight. So, can everybody see that? Yeah, good. You start it from the beginning. It does have my speaker's notes on it, but you guys will have to see that too. So I'm not going to use them. So hopefully I'll remember everything that I want to tell you. So thanks, Anne. Yes, I am Dr. Stephanie Jurstad. I am a professor of criminology with Millersville University. It's a state university in Pennsylvania in Lancaster County. And it's the Department of Sociology, Criminology, and Anthropology, but I am the only criminologist of the department. So I teach all of our criminology courses and some of our elective courses. And one of the courses that I was able to develop last semester was a sex crimes and victimization course. And I really wanted to introduce our students to really debunking myths and being able to share actual facts with some of our young students. And it was a positive course. I had them take a like a pre-test and a post-test of attitudes and perceptions, and we saw that there was an actual change to the positive in attitudes and perceptions. So that was nice to see. So I'm going to talk to you guys a little bit about housing obstacles that people face that are forced to register. And unfortunately, I don't have all the answers, and I'm going to be sharing a lot of information, some of the just evidence that I've been able to find through the course of my research and also the course of my professional experiences too. So I don't know that we'll go through every slide tonight, but we'll just start with what I have, and then we'll go through it and have conversations. I'm a pretty informal presenter. So tonight's conversation, I wanted to kind of introduce to you like why this topic, especially for me, but why this topic is important. What do we know? What don't we know? And what evidence has been able to tell us? So, John, John is an actual person, and back in 2016, I was a homeless case manager. I was an actual case manager with the Department of Veteran Affairs. I worked with veterans who were homeless or at imminent risk of losing their permanent nighttime shelter. And John was assigned to my case. He was in the hospital, and we were needing to get him into permanent housing once he was being discharged from the hospital. But through that course of the hospitalization, we really determined that permanent housing was going to be more like a nursing home facility for him. And because he was a person that was forced to register, between myself, another case manager, and a hospital case manager, we contacted 200 and I think 221, 212 nursing homes in the state of Illinois. That's where we were living at the time. And no one would accept him because of his registry status. And he ended up dying before I could ever find him permanent housing. So, to be quite frank, that pissed me off. Like, everybody should have access to medical care, regardless of their, prior history. And I knew that I was finishing up my master's degree at that time, and I knew I was going to be getting my PhD to continue research, and just knew that at that point in time, that had to be what I was going to take on as my research area of interest and topic. So collateral consequences has always been an area of research for me, and particularly with housing, being a homeless case manager. So I knew at that point we needed to talk about these non-traditional housing sources and what that looked like for somebody that was forced to register. So my whole dissertation is actually dedicated in memory of John. So some of the consequences, I know that all of you guys, know all of this, and of course this is not an exhaustive list of the consequences of the registry. But of course I put housing in bold, because I believe that, as a housing case manager, that was really the most difficult and most challenging barrier that individuals face when they're, returning back into society. So, but I wanted you to list some of the other things that we talk about that are important. And again, this is not an exhaustive list. So we know that housing is a significant restriction, a significant barrier. But what about those non-traditional housing exclusions? And long-term care facilities are one of them. We also know that even homeless shelters, I know in the town that I lived in, we had two. One did allow those that were forced to register to stay the night there, but the other housing, the homeless shelter did not. And we know that the majority of them do not allow them to stay overnight in their facility. So, yeah. So I wanted to talk to you guys tonight specifically about, non-traditional housing placements. So when this happened to John, I wanted to know, like, what is the scope of the problem? Like, was this, we were living in Indiana at the time. John really wanted to be in Illinois because it was going to be closer to his family. So I really wanted to find out, like, is this an isolated practice? Is this a universal practice? Like, how prevalent was this? Was it just because of where we were living at the time, or was this like, a problem that is needs to be identified across the United States? And then I was wondering, like, is there a state statute that actually informs nursing homes, like, how they might admit someone on the registry, or someone with a sexual harm conviction? Or was this more of just a business practice, like a company policy? And then I wanted to find out, if this is a state legislation, like, what are some unique characteristics about a state, or some characteristics about a facility, or even individual attitudes and perceptions and admission practices at the individual level. So asking all of those questions, I really took on a big research project with my dissertation. So what I found out, and what you can see on this screen, is this is a list of states And you can see those states that actually have X's, those actually indicate states that have the presence of a state statute that actually informs long-term care facilities how they might admit someone that's forced to register or has a prior sexual harm conviction, how they might manage them if they do admit them into a nursing home. So you can see that there's 12 states that have actual legislation.
And this is
Florida.
positive legislation. This is they are allowing people in, and they're.
This is legislation that states that they have to, that they could deny someone that's forced to register, or if nursing homes are allowing them to be admitted, then they have to abide by certain statute that says how they can admit them and manage them and supervise them in their care. So in theory, you would want to see none of these states selected. You'd want to see no state statutes that actually.
Oh, okay. So this is just saying if there's a statute. This doesn't necessarily
Yes.
say every long-term care facility in the other places will let you in.
Exactly.
You're just saying that the state hasn't like put their two cents in.
Right. But
Ah.
these are the 12 states that have.
And in those 12 states, have all the work that's been done by the state, all the law legislation ne negative for us?
Yeah. Pretty
Oh,
much. Yeah.
yikes.
Yes.
Okay, so an X means the state has pitched in on the hating
Yes.
campaign.
Yes.
Okay,
So
thank you.
Florida doesn't have a state statute, but they do have municipalities and pockets within Florida that have their own, like, municipality type of ordinances or, legislation that says that, if a nursing home is going to admit someone on the registry, this is what it says. And we'll talk about that in a minute. So important to note, all of the states that have legislation, I call it long-term care sex offender legislation. They were drafted, developed, and enacted in between the years of 2005 and 2010, which kind of makes sense. We kind of had some more legislation going on during that time period. So in the last 14 years, there hasn't been any new legislation, but that doesn't mean that it's still not considered, a hot topic by people that want to not admit someone into a nursing home. So, but this kind of gives you an overview about the states that actually have legislation that inform nursing home practices. Okay. This screen here talks about, so when I look at legislation, I have to look at like, what are some common themes? So we know we have 12 states that have legislation in pockets of Florida. So looking at the language of the law, I wanted to see what is similar across the board. Okay. So this tells you here at the top, these are common themes. So when you look at language of the law, words like notification, disclosure of status, using registry as a screening tool, residency restrictions, individualized care plans and supervision and segregation. So you can see like the most common theme is notification. So of all of the states, eight states have this theme of notification. And what notification means in this context is that nursing homes, if they do admit someone that's forced to register or has a prior conviction, they must notify the other residents. Visitors, family members, staff, that someone that's living in their facility is someone that's forced to register or has a prior sexual harm conviction. And it looks a little bit different depending on the state that you're living in. In Illinois, notification just means they need to provide all of the people that I just mentioned, the steps to access their state's sex offender registry. Okay, so it could be something simple as that. That they just have to tell them, this is where you can find if someone is living in our facility. But they do have to post signage at the doorways that say someone in this facility is forced to register. Ohio, for example, their notification is more like taking what you would see on the sex offender, on their state sex offender registry, their picture, their offenses, their like who their victim might be. And that is actually handed out to everybody. So again, some very punitive practices within these admission decisions, right? Disclosure of status is that the applicant is, has to disclose that they are someone that's forced to register or has a prior sexual offense conviction. If they don't, it is guaranteed that they would then be discharged from that facility if they do not disclose their status. A lot of the states use the registry as a screening tool. So doing background checks and using the registry to screen someone to either deny or say that they will admit someone that's on the registry. We have some states that use the residency restriction. If that state has a residency restriction, they use that to say, well, this facility is close to a daycare, is close to a school, is close to a park. So because of that, now we were not going to allow them admission into our facility. So they use that really as an excuse to say, they can't be admitted. Individualized care plan is something that only three states do, but it's really kind of like a safety plan. Like if we do admit someone that is forced to register or has a prior conviction, this is how we're going to keep really other people safe. It's not so much about the, individual resident. It's more about how are we going to keep other people safe. And then supervision and segregation is saying that if we admit them, they have to have their own room, be close to the nurse's station, have more supervision, and really kind of segregate them from general population. So that is what the legislation talks about in terms of language. And I put this slide on here just because they really use, sex offender legislation to form these policies. So they look at language that was used in, the Jacob Wetterling Act or the Megan's Law or the Adam Walsh Act. They use language and then try to insert that into a nursing home care policy. So after looking at like legislation, then I wanted to find out like, okay, so we have 12 states that have these long-term care sex offender policies legislation, like why would a state even draft something like that? So you look then at like how punitive a state might be. And so some of the characteristics of state punitiveness might be, population. It might be, the larger the state, the more punitive in their criminal justice responses to crime, crime rate, incarceration rate. You might consider like states that have the death penalty, three strikes laws, disenfranchisement laws, like those states might be more punitive. So then, therefore, they might draft a policy that would restrict, individuals in entering a nursing home facility, or states that have, residency restrictions, states that have civil commitment laws, states that actually have lifetime GPS monitoring. Like they might be more punitive, so then therefore they might, try to draft and enact a policy such as this. I did test, it didn't matter, but I did test things like states that are more Republican versus Democrat, like governors who are Republican, looked at like the rate of foster care, more children in foster care might mean more punitive responses. Snap bans for certain, crime offenses, but those didn't matter. But I did test them to see if like, politics and some of those like social benefits mattered.
And did they?
They did not. So the only
Huh.
thing that mattered, actually, let me go back to this. The only thing that mattered out of all of this was population and residency restrictions and civil commitment. But then when we put all three of those together to test to see like the strength of like how strong those indicators are, population was explained away. It didn't matter anymore. And only
The only two things that The only two things that make a difference are residency restrictions and civil commitment.
correct. And It's enough so that if a state has a residency restriction, they're 14 times more likely to have a nursing home care policy. If a state has a civil commitment law, they are 10 times more likely to have a nursing home care law. So,
So it sounds to me like, the politicians who are, the politicians who are using this for whatever the reason, I think they're doing it because they want us to be scared so that they can get us to trade freedom for safety. But whoever's, the same politician that's writing the residency restrictions is probably the guy who's writing the civil commitment rules.
yeah, probably so. Because civil commitment, changed over time. Originally, civil commitment wasn't even written for someone that has a criminal offense at all. It was, originally written for those that had a mental health diagnosis, like a, pretty severe mental health diagnosis. But then in 1995, Florida was actually the first state that wrote into their civil commitment law that someone who is deemed a sexually violent predator would also be considered under civil commitment. So in 1995 is when states started making the change and adding, other actual criminal justice offenses into their civil commitment laws. So those are the only two that matter. So then I wanted to look at then, okay, well, of those 12 states, including Florida, so 13 altogether, that have some sort of long-term care sex offender law, how many of them have civil commitment and how many of them have, residency restrictions too? And then how many of them had both? So you can kind of see like the majority of the states have, what is that? Both. So one, two, three, five, six. So I guess half of the states have, a civil commitment and a residency restriction law in addition to a long-term care facility sex offender law. So then looking at states, what was it about like facilities? Like, is there something about a facility that might matter when making, policy decisions on whether or not to admit or deny? And so I looked at occupancy rate, I looked at insurance type, I looked at size, patient staff to ratio, but the only like characteristic that mattered was ownership type. And ownership type was looked at for profit and not for profit. So facilities that are not for profit are actually more likely to admit someone that is forced to register or has a prior offense conviction. So
Yeah, that would have been my guess because people who chose this line of work because they have a soft spot for people while they're aging and they know that everybody needs this. They under like they're doing it for the reason that doesn't make it easy for them to kick somebody out.
Yeah, for sure. They
They're
also,
not doing it to make money.
right. And it was also found that, and I'll talk about it a little bit more too, when I'm like having those interviews with long-term care facility administrators, but not-for-profit facilities also have like more latitude in the use of their discretion to make admission decisions versus a for-profit
Yep.
company.
Have to go to their board of directors or whatever.
So for-profit was the only thing that mattered in terms of characteristics. So I wanted to talk to long-term care facility administrators because I wanted to know like their own attitudes and perceptions about like, do they favor their company policy? Would they make admission exceptions if they could? Like, what do they think about someone who's forced to register? Do they feel like they would be a threat to their, residential population? So I was able to at least, I had 23 of them had to be excluded just because they were for like intellectual disability homes and not long-term care facilities. So I was able to talk to 17 administrators, and you can see like the majority of them would make admission exceptions if they could. In the state of Illinois, their hands are tied based on that long-term care sex offender legislation. It actually takes discretion away from them to be able to make those admission exceptions. So prior to 2005, long-term care facility administrators had a little bit more latitude to make those admission exceptions. But then once legislation was tied to, admission decisions, it really took away some of that discretion. Now, in terms of in favor of company policy, I'll talk a little bit about that, I think, on the next slide. But you can see the majority of them are in favor of their company policy, whether that's to admit or not admit, So I'll show you that on the next slide. And then they talk about, the use of residency restrictions and that the location of their facility matters. Whether I think that more so is an excuse that they're using to say that, we can't have anyone, living here that's on the registry because of where we're located in the community. And then room placement, some of them talked a lot about room placement and that even if their company policy is to admit someone that's forced to register because they don't have proper room placement within the facility, they have to deny them. Now, whether or not we know if that's true or not, I don't know. I mean, they could be saying to anyone, like, we would admit you, but we don't have a room that's a single room or near the nurse's station. Like, we would never have an idea whether or not that's true or not. So, all right. So, when we talk to long-term care facility administrators, you can see that those that do admit, those that are forced to register, all of them are okay with that. All of those seven that do admit, they're okay with company policy. Those that do not admit someone on the registry, you can see that seven of them agree with that they're okay with that company policy, but three of them are not okay with that. Three of them disagree with their company policy. So I think that, kind of shows that there is some level of empathy among some of the administrators, but their hands are tied in terms of, whether or not they could say yes or no to someone. And I learned that long-term care facility administrators that have a nursing background are more empathetic and they really look at the individual applicant holistically, whereas an administrator with a business background, like a master's in business, like an MBA, it's all about risk management. It's all about mitigating risk. The answer is always going to be no. There is no, yes, this person has been offense-free for 30 years, and now they're the average nursing home patient in the United States is 85. And we know that evidence tells us that, the likelihood that somebody would reoffend is minuscule, doesn't matter. It's all about liability and risk. So, and that goes to kind of like this slide is that, risk management is a top priority. And that the legislation states that have legislation actually remove discretion. But even those states, even though we're saying there's only 12 states that have, legislation that informs long-term care facilities on how they must admit certain, certain individuals, we also know that company policy really trumps what state legislation tells them to do. So, if you're in a state that has a state legislation, your company policy pretty much also dictates who's being admitted and who's not being admitted. So even though, what would that be? 38 states don't have legislation. We know that in the state of Pennsylvania, that the majority of long-term care facilities do not admit someone on the registry or with a prior offense conviction, and we're a state that doesn't have legislation. So I guess part of what I'm saying is I don't know that it matters if there's legislation or not, because company policy really trumps that anyway. And residents.
Do you have any like wild guess number? What percent of just not states, but nursing homes say yes versus no? You have any idea like
I don't
what?
have an idea, Anne, but you'd have to think anecdotally that knowing, let's just take Illinois, for example, since a lot of the data originally came from Illinois, there's, 800 and I think at the time 69 facilities, and maybe 80, like 10% might admit them.
Wow.
So then if you're talking about 80 out of, 869, then you have to call those 80 to find out, do they even have an open bed for someone? Who's the administrator during, because there's a lot of turnover with nursing home administrators for sure. Who's that administrator at the time? What's their background? And so we know that the majority of facilities are not admitting someone that's forced to register or has a prior sexual harm conviction, which is problematic because of the registry and a lot of our individuals being forced to register for lifetime. And it doesn't even, and the registry is a problem for, but they're still excluding, even if they're not on the registry, they're still excluding people with a prior sexual harm conviction too. But we also know that because of lifetime registry, I mean, a lot of these individuals that may need long-term care in the future that are forced to register for life, there's, if they're on the registry, like I said, they would be, the majority of them would be eliminated from receiving long-term care. So yeah. In the last journal article I did that's being waiting to be published was looking at it, like removing it from a criminal justice response, right? And looking at it more as a public health response. Because we could say, right, that this is a public health issue. It's a public health crisis. Like you're denying people access to medical treatment. This is a human rights issue. This is a medical ethics issue. It's a social justice issue. And we are continuing to punish people, versus, focusing on prevention through a public health lens. So Dr. Jill Levinson and I together, we talk about this in this upcoming article that'll be published, and looking at it through a public health response and looking at it through, language that could be connected to a public health discussion instead of a criminal justice response to crime and criminal behavior. So, some of the things that are next is we need to continue. I say we, I'm only one person, but, this is still my life's passion to continue researching on, to answer your question, and like, what is the actual scope of the problem? We know it's a problem, but in order to, effectuate change and hopefully have change in the future, we have to have, it has to be data driven. And so we really need to start looking at like, what are the actual numbers? In 2005, the Government Accountability Office did a study. I think they looked at five or six states, but they wanted to see like into how many of the nursing home population were was on the registry. And it was like 0.07% of the nursing home population that were living in nursing homes at that time in 2005 that were, forced to register. So it was a very small number of the nursing home population, but that it also makes sense because they're not admitting them anyway, right? Like,
Right.
so
Yeah.
we
If
would
a bunch
expect
of them are
that,
saying no,
right? We
and
would
then the
expect
few that
that
are
number to
saying
be
yes.
small. Yeah, we would expect that number to be small anyway. But I think their point was saying, see, there's, we don't need to make a big deal of having all of this legislation to kind of force nursing homes to deny these people because there's not that many people that are living in nursing homes that are forced to register anyway. Well, but then
There's
the
a reason for that because they're
conversation,
living in
yeah,
a camp.
conversation, exactly. The conversation then needed to be like, but why is that then? And that wasn't something that they were really examining at the time. And, and then in Illinois, Paul, I see your hand, and I'll ask, get you here in just a second. Like in Illinois, originally the Illinois Nursing Home Care Act was being developed because they wanted to protect residents from staff, from people who were actually working within the nursing home that were committing crimes, like they were actually abusing, residents. So that's how it was the original intent of the legislation was pr to protect residents from staff. Well, as of course they were writing it, they were like, well, shouldn't we then protect residents from other residents? Well, then that means that we need to protect residents from people who are forced to register or have a prior conviction. So that's how that got lumped into legislation. That wasn't the original intent
Oh, wow.
of the
So it was
legislation
really meant to protect the residents of the place
from the people that were working
from
inside
the
the
people that were working
facility.
there. Yeah. And I'm sure we didn't really fix that problem.
No, probably not. Probably
Just
not.
like 25 years of the registry hasn't fixed the problem of kids are getting touched by someone that they know in their family. Not the guy down the street that they've never talked to. That's just not how it works.
So, when people say, well, then, nursing homes have to report abuse, whether it's resident or resident abuse, staff on resident abuse. They have to report that to their ombudsman's office and the Department of Health. And so then people will ask, like, well, then how many of those resident to resident sexual misconduct is, by a resident who has a prior conviction? Well, you're not admitting them anyway. So it's none of them. But administrators admit that people who have dementia and Alzheimer's, like those cognitive impairments, like they're more likely to act out in sexual misconduct by the nature of their, disease, so their disease processes. So when you talk to facility administrators, they're actually more worried about those individuals that have like dementia and Alzheimer's and cognitive impairment versus someone who doesn't have cognitive impairment and with any, prior offense conviction, especially those that are forced to register. Like they're more worried about those individuals acting out because it's a byproduct of their, disease processes. So,
Yeah, I mean, can I just say a thing that I'm thinking that I'm probably not supposed to say out loud, but like, why does this have to be the world's scariest, worstest thing that, old dudes when they're losing their mental facilities like to touch their junk? Like, I don't even get big deal or like, I don't know. I don't know what they're doing, but it's just hard for me to imagine some old dude in a nursing home luring children in off the street so he can. Like it's hard for me to imagine that, and I bet there's not many stories like that. I'd be surprised if there were any stories like that.
at all. So I unfortunately I don't have the answer of what do we do from here in terms of like, okay, but if I do have someone that needs nursing home care but is forced to register and or has a prior conviction, like, who do we call and what do we do? And really, I can
Yeah.
only tell you, like,
Start now.
start out with a facility really that had that's not for profit. Somebody that whose facility administrator has a nursing background versus, a business background. Like, but those are all, I mean, those are it's so time consuming and taxing in terms of like even trying to find, a facility that would admit someone. So then you have to think about this has to then, because I know from John's experience, this has to then, because they're denied access to medical treatment, which is skilled care, right? They need skilled care treatment. They qualify for that. So they are in a position that they need skilled care. You have to think that if they're being denied this, which kind of goes back to the public health response, we're speeding up their morbidity, right? Like, it has to. Like it would be very difficult
Well,
to test
honestly, I
that,
don't
but
even think saying that out loud would change some people's mind.
no, I don't
Like,
think so.
literally, some people will respond to what you just said and say, well, good, bleh.
So what if
That's
they're
the
dying?
way, that's the attitude that people have been
Absolutely.
having, and people just roll over and put up with it. It's,
Yeah, for sure.
and yeah, the whole idea that this is the way we want people. Like, who even voted for this? This is awful. It's just gross. Well, I'll tell you what, the thing that I'm thinking in the back of my head today is I have a 24-year-old daughter who has always loved old people. She just I don't know, has always loved old people. And she works at a nursing home, or it's not a nursing home, it's like a long whatever, old people who need some help, but they're not in the nursing home yet. Assisted living
Living,
facility.
yeah.
And I'm thinking, how many years is it going to take me to convince her to open up a nurse to, you know, invest in opening up a nursing home that is a bit, you know, open to all,
Yeah.
and probably would just fill up with people on the registry.
Yeah, I think it was back in 2010. It failed in, I guess, the House or the Senate, but in Oklahoma, they actually had legislation on the books that would build actual long-term care facilities in the state of Oklahoma, specifically for those that were forced to register. It didn't pass, and I can definitely see some pros and cons to, having such facility, but it didn't pass. I don't know if it's going to be reintroduced at any time, but I know there's some legislation that I was just sent earlier this week. I need to look at some things going on in Oklahoma right now that I need to look at, but
I don't remember. Was Oklahoma one of the like XX ones?
let me go back because now that I've been removed, where are we going here? So Oklahoma does have a long-term care facility, sex offender legislation.
Okay.
So, they implemented this and then they probably thought, okay, well then what are we going to do with them? And then probably somebody wrote the bill, but it didn't pass. So.
Yeah, because some people are literally so hatey and hateful that they don't mind seeing our guys in a camp tent encampment. But there've got to be people who do understand that that's not good.
Not okay. Yeah. Well, I know I've got lots of questions, so Anna, I'll let you like feel. It's hard for me
Yes,
to see
okay.
like who's got
Yes, absolutely. That this is my task.
it. Okay.
So earlier there was another hand up. I don't know what happened
I
to it.
think Paul had a hand
Briefly.
up, maybe.
Yeah, it was Paul. I don't know how to hang on a second. I close the chat for a second so I can find Paul again. There's Paul. All right, Paul, I'm unmuting you.
Great. Thank you so much. Paul, I'm in Chicago. I'm a person forced to register. I don't come here too often, so I'll try to keep it brief. Really glad to have Dr. Gerstad with us. Comment and a question. I did work in long-term care. I worked for a family-owned company that owned five long-term care facilities in Chicago, and I got to witness the back office decision-making on this topic. And it was 100% entirely a fiscal business decision based on the cost of having a single room and the cost of the additional nursing ratio for supervision. Those two factors, it's not that they made it unprofitable, but they made it less profitable. And the owners are generally paying the administrators with a bonus based on a bed utilization ratio. And so single rooms provide the worst bed utilization. They're constantly trying to move people into doubles or triples or even quads because that improves their profitability. So there were, lots of other topics were brought up later as masks or policy, but the decision was really just entirely based on the cost of the single room and the cost of the additional care. There's somebody in Chicago who's looking at possibly like buying split-level homes and making them three or four person long-term care facilities. Those probably would meet the criteria for registry. So there's some conversations going on with that owner to see if they maybe want to pick homes at locations that are registrable. Ben, I'm sorry, the question I had was actually about your Illinois data. We actually were you able to map like the age bubble of people on the registry in Illinois to see like the shape of the problem as it approaches its 70s and 80s for the age bubble?
No, I did not, but that's a great idea. And let me go back to this screen, Paul. Send me that question in an email, and I'll see what I can do in terms of, looking at that data and being able to merge that data together. But also keep me informed with, some of those discussions about what you just mentioned with Chicago and potential access to care. So, yeah, appreciate that. Okay.
All right, I think Mike, your hand is up next.
Okay, can you hear me?
I can.
Okay. I don't need long-term care, and I've been off the registry for 2-3 years when I was successful in my petition, but I ran into a situation that I had to resolve this week where, okay, I've got neighbors that found out that I used to be on the registry and the stigma carried with it. Well, they've raised such a fit that and I live in government subsidized housing, so you got to send in a ton of paperwork.
Yep.
Okay, so in sending in that paperwork, my military retirement income was allegedly never reported. However, they were able to use that amount in my rent calculations. So to me, that's a little bit of a double standard.
Mm-hmm.
So what has wound up happening is they filed a complaint with the USDA.
Okay.
Okay. So now I know this doesn't really sound like it's registry, but the situation I think stems from the fact that for the last 2.5 years, a few neighbors have raised such a complaint about my existence that they would do anything to get me removed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, luckily enough, my background checks came back that, you know, it looked better than I really thought it would. I knew I was not supposed to be on the registry, but had that gone a different direction, then I would have been sleeping in a tent.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I don't know if this is a question, but this problem is not just localized to the elderly and long-term.
Right, right.
You know, and I mean, I'm really glad that you did your presentation. It was really done. But I mean, there's a lot of people like me that I think get pushed out by their neighbors, and then mm-hmm. the hate just is horrible. I meet with my state representative roughly once a month.
Okay.
And he has seen the text messages and the Facebook post. And, you know, he's told me, he said, if you know, he wants me to work with him on this issue, especially if something comes across.
Yeah.
That was kind of a narrative about a situation that could also be part of the homeless problem.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. And I'm glad that you brought that up, because, you know, definitely you're right. It's not just, you know, an aging, you know, individual conversation. But a lot of people don't think about the impact that, you know, when they are aging, you know, what happens in those long-term care, you know, admission decisions. Like, people aren't thinking about it if they're not having to, you know, if it's not even on their radar yet, right? So having this conversation, I think, is important, just to even know what, you know, what might it look like down the road for somebody.
Right. And if the laws change in 10 years, you know, I'm going to be in my mid-70s.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how well I'll do in the Missouri winters and at that age.
Right.
You know,
right.
If I, you know, wind back, you know.
Yeah.
So
thanks for sharing, Michael. I appreciate, I'm sorry that you're having to go through that, but I do appreciate you know, sharing that today.
All right, Jim, you're up.
First of all, Michael, thank you for that share. And I think it's your courage is great, and I really appreciate it. And Stephanie, it's always good to hear you. So mm-hmm. I was wondering, you know, looking at nursing homes in a public health zone, would there be any way to challenge denials based on medical need rather than registry status? Because there's also, you know, do no harm. And, you know, all of us, either registered citizens or formally registered, I'm off the registry also, I still have medical needs.
Right. Yeah. And I think, Jen, I think you bring up a good point. Like, Is there a way, or could there be a way, or will there be a way in the future that someone could, challenge those admission decisions? I don't know
Yes.
that that's something that we can, that they have the capability of doing now, but like you said, through a
It's
public health
time.
lens, could that be a potential ask down the road? Yeah, good thinking.
John.
Good evening. Good and many, many thanks for a very much needed talk.
Well, you're welcome, John. Thanks.
I just wanted to essentially share a couple of comments. One, I think so many, and I'm preaching to the choir, I know, but I think it needs to be said again. When a lot of these laws are passed, their knee-jerk reaction that maybe one person has experienced, and suddenly, like that, it's a one-size-fits-all answer. And what's the saying? Act in haste, repent at leisure. We've been trying a little bit more, not only to show the confusion of registration laws, the registry, everything here in Arkansas. We've also been trying to start asking, especially newly elected legislators, if they have any awareness, any idea as to the collateral damage and the financial impact that these laws are starting to have. Now, others will talk about the financial aspect. My, if you will, elevator speech is, do you know what the minimum age is in Arkansas to put a person on the Arkansas registry? And the overwhelming majority have no idea. And when I tell them, one of our leaders brought it to a meeting of some members of our state legislature, two huge, three-ring folders that had all of the current sex offense laws, registry restrictions, all of that printed out. And she made a very, very definite point of dropping them from about a foot or so up, so where they would hit the desk with a very loud, very noticeable thump. But then there's going to come, I think there's going to come the time that we need to start taking a look at how much all of this is costing the insert name of state here, taxpayer. And it's costing on some grounds what it's costing the federal taxpayer. And again, being prepared to back up, like with the research you've been doing, the research that, say, Emily Horowitz and Jill Levinson have been doing, the research, the publication, for example, that the American Law Institute has been doing. So this may be something that, well, that more and more people are going to have to be aware of and perhaps utilizing. The one other thing I wanted to share, and you've heard me bring this up before, but there's kind of a new wrinkle to it. Sometime back, I had a good exchange of information with a U.S. district attorney in the state of Delaware. This U.S. district attorney had come up with a simulation, a role-playing game, if you want to call it that, of what it's like to be released from prison to get back into the community. Now, it was not sex offender specific. Hang on. It was not sex offender specific, and it was, but it was targeting a very specific group of participants. The participants, without exception, failed in this simulation. The group that was singled out for participation were prosecuting attorneys. I got her simulation information. Now, the new wrinkle is that I learned that someone, I believe, at one of the universities in Iowa is working along similar lines to make it more registrant focused. I haven't had the opportunity to get in touch with that person as yet. That is definitely on my to-do list priority. But these simulation, I think, could be a very, very good and, as of the present, underutilized teaching tool. And I'd like to get your feedback on that, the other comments that I've been making.
Yeah. So I'm sure it was a re-entry simulation, and we do those with our students and our community members. It's not just open to students. I mean, it's open to community members also.
General, or is it also sex offender
No,
specific?
so the ones that have been conducted on campus and in the community have just been general, reentry simulation. So if they do come out with more of a focused, targeted, population, I'd love to have that, information to see how they were able to change, some of the points along the reentry, processes. So, but I think it's important, we have poverty simulations, reentry simulations, and I think they can be very powerful and impactful for certain people. So thanks for sharing that, John. And I hope that if it is Iowa, a university in Iowa that's working on it and making it specific, I think that I'd love to, see what that looks like when they get that
Awesome.
done.
All right, Jerry, you're up.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, cool. I think I found my solution to the housing problem is fine. I found me a spot. I was looking for a spot in the country, but then I met a wonderful woman, and so I've got a place here. But if that's an option for people, get outside the school zones, get into a place where you don't have restrictions on what kind of structure you can have, and establish your spot outside the urban area. I think part of the problem is going to be if you're in the urban area and we concentrate sex offenders into particular areas, that makes that group a bigger target. For the people that, want to avenge the abuse, whatever, it's easier to target a group than it is an individual. And there's no easy solutions. And I think everything that's being presented is a good, it's good talk, but we are a group of people that don't want the public image. We don't want people to see us because we feel retaliation. There's actual individuals that they justify their violence by saying, this is a person that, and there's a lot of things going on. And so, it's, we on the list, we're a target group, and that's just what it is. Every society needs a scapegoat, and that's what we are.
Yeah,
And,
that is the truth.
it's sad, it's true, but I found, and even before I met this wonderful woman I'm with now, I was going to find me a spot in the country. I was going to be outside the school zones. And so when they come to me, I said, look, I'm doing everything your law tells me I got to do. Leave me alone. So that's not an option for everybody. And I
Right.
know that, in 25 years, I can be reviewed and maybe taken off the list. But this list is never going to be, quote, too expensive to maintain. When it gets to a point that the state can't maintain it or the county or municipality can't maintain it, they're going to force the registered person to fund their own registry. And when I go in and update, renew my address, every like 3 or 4 times a year, I have to pay $10. If I change something, it's $5. So they're already making me pay something. So
Sure.
the cost of my freedom is at least $40 a year. But this is it's not going to change because I can stand up and make a public statement where everybody sees me, but I don't have enough people in my group standing up and making the same statement. So, that's one of our biggest hurdles is because there is a group of people that would attack us if we make a public statement. And so, I can't go around and say, grab somebody by the arm and say, come on, let's stand up and let's form a crowd. I mean, every group that's been oppressed by society has been able to push that repression back because they could stand up as a group. We lack that because we know that's putting our face on TV with this over our head. We know that we're subject to being attacked.
Yeah.
But
Yep.
at least we have a group of people that are willing to get into a Zoom call and at least talk,
Yeah. Yeah. It's a
I think
safe
this is
space for you.
gonna change. I don't think this can last. I don't know when it's gonna change, but it's the government is getting so crazy. If it was just old dudes who touched their niece, you'd probably be there forever. But they're getting really nuts. They're having people like I had a guy call me the other day. He hooked up with somebody on Tinder. She came over 3 days in a row and they just had sex all day. And then the fourth day she came over and said, I don't think I'm up for it. Can you take me to my friend's house? He took her to her friend's house. bunch of hours pass. She comes back later that night. The cops come by and say there's been an allegation, and she accused of some kind of sexual misconduct. And then she recanted her testimony. Three times she tried to recant, and they just kept hounding her and torturing. You know, they're doing stuff like that. They've just lost their minds, and it's gonna kill them. It's gonna kill them eventually.
Well, if we're on the list, Tinder, we need to stay away from Tinder and groups like that, because there's at least Tinder and the most of them groups are either owned by police departments or they are really closely monitored by police departments. Those are places that we need to stay away from, because
Well, this
a
guy
lot of
wasn't on
times,
the registry before. He
yeah.
got put on the registry because of this Tinder thing.
This gal.
Yeah, because of the
And it
Tinder
was
thing.
consensual, and it was she was adult. She was an adult. He had consensual adult sex with an adult, and he's on the registry.
Yeah, because
That's
if she,
I didn't even get it. That doesn't even make any sense.
that's part of the Me Too generation, And I mean, it's one thing to say, "Hey, I've been attacked," but it's another thing to say, "Okay, if you want to say you've been attacked, all you have to do is just say you've been attacked, and the state will take your charge, and now it's the state charge." And the state has the right to pursue it to the full extent of the law. So, that becomes a that is a whole different ball of wax, But there's a lot of people looking at Tinder and quote, she's 10 years old or five, 15 or whatever, and she's saying that she's that old. No, she ain't. It's an old man in a room,
Oh yeah, that
basically,
happens. That happens all the time. That's another. That's
all the
the
time.
net nanny sting.
Yeah.
It's spreading like wildfire in different states.
It
Yeah, we've
started
had the
out as a
lady
private
that.
individual. Started out as a private individual. Now every single state does the same thing. And you want to stay off the registry, you don't pursue those. You just leave that stuff alone.
Well, and that's what we, I mean, the thing that we should be protecting our children from is this. It's all these tricky ways to get you on this list and destroy your life. That's what we need to be talking about, you know.
Yeah, and I'm glad you let me in. I'm glad my microphone worked for me. But yeah, I need to go. But it's been a good conversation, and
Yeah,
thank
it's
you, Jerry. Change is coming. We're working on it.
I think if there's ever any kind of conventions or anything where we could actually meet face to face, if I'm in the area where I can, it'd be great to do.
Where do you live,
But
Jerry?
South Central Missouri, West Plains. But
Oh, I'm in Missouri.
yeah, you're up toward St. Louis, I believe.
Yeah,
But
I'm in St. Louis.
so anyway, like I said, it's been a great talk, and the more we talk, the stronger we get. So
Yeah,
good
change
luck
is
to
coming.
everybody. Yeah,
Thank you.
good
Thank
luck
you for
to
your question,
everybody,
Jerry.
and I'll talk to you in 2 weeks.
All right, JB. Oh, I love your background.
Thank you. I took a picture when I was in New York at MoMA. Dr. Gerstedt, it's a pleasure to
Yes.
see you. I actually attended the PARSL conference, and you, or I should say, when you did your speech through them, and I was very inspired. I actually spoke to you about helping place an individual. This is kind of, I'm not quite there yet, but I'm helping some individuals here in California. So I did come up with a few things, a few ideas
Good.
specifically on this topic. So I'm going to throw them out to you. Whether they help you, whether they pertain only to California, other states, I don't know all other states, but one is I've one individual I know, I can't, in California, I have something called Megan's List, which shows where everybody is on a map, where they're located, the 290s are. So I know of one
Okay.
individual I recommended them to go on the list, and here's a list that's supposed to hurt you, and they found a nursing home that way. So that's one way of doing it. If these maps are in different locations and states, is to actually, it depends on whether you can legally look at them. I can't, but having somebody that's not on the registry look at these sites and see if they can track and spot a facility that already is a assisted living or nursing home.
Okay.
So that's one idea I found successful. Another thing is in
Yes.
California, we have something called board and care facilities, and these are usually private homes, and most of them will accept. I have found out, in fact, I was able to place an individual in one of these, and this individual gets home health care, which they can't discriminate, at least in California they can't, where they have nurses that come in and assist the individual. So if the person isn't too far along and too handicapped, that's a possibility. Lastly, and I've checked this, the third thing and last thing is I checked this with Jana Belushi, who is an attorney, also the head of Axel, basically, and individuals on tier one and two. Now, I don't know all the other states and so forth, but in California, if they're on tier one and two, the federal government cannot discriminate them getting assisted housing. And that, in other words, provide for financially with them in assisted housing. So that's been, I know, productive for some individuals here in the state, whether they're on tier one or two, where we have three tiers in California, mm-hmm. and that way they can provide some assisted housing. But the old standby is sober living houses, but that's something that, you know, individuals, it's kind of hard to take care of. But I found based on somewhat my own nature trying to help other people, and also by your parcel presentation a few months back, that has inspired me. I wanted to give you the information. I have done some homework on it.
Yeah,
thank you for your efforts.
You're welcome, JB, and thank you for doing that. And I was actually making notes as you were like talking, so hopefully I got what you said correct in my notes, so thank you for that. I'm going to put my email in the chat so that JB, you could send that to me too, so that I don't forget, or that I make sure that I wrote that down correctly. So there you go.
So this has been a pretty, you know, pretty depressing topic, I realize. Joy, you want to leave us, you want to raise your hand and say some positive things? I'm unmuting you.
Yeah.
You're always so good at this.
We actually have something coming to our state where it's exactly what he was talking about with the reentry simulation, but virtual. But they actually gave me the reins to do it, and I'm a person on the registry. So I'm going to make sure that it's completely fair, honest, and real. It's not going to exclude us. It's going to be randomized, and whoever gets it is going to definitely feel that experience. And Stephanie's right here, and the person, they asked me to form a team. So what I'm going to do is I'm definitely going to beg Stephanie to join our team because we need her. Yeah. Like, I'm begging her. I'm waiting to talk to her after her semester, and she needs to join this team. So there is good stuff coming for us. It's really progressive in Pennsylvania right now. I didn't think it was. I attended the Parcel Conference and the Park Conference, and I left with like a lot of hope. So I can't wait until we get to get our feet on the ground and get this right. So we needed to hear what Stephanie had to say tonight, though, because it's reality. So this is what we're going to put into the simulation. So when they put those goggles on, when they take the goggles off, they'll walk away like they saw E.T.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, and the good thing is too, you know, Joseph and I were at the same conference last Friday, and we had one of the gentlemen from our attorney general's office, Robert Reed, right, Joseph? So
yeah,
I think we have some advocates in our corner for sure.
Definitely, I would not just be saying that for us.
Yeah,
100%. I felt super confident.
Yeah,
as a person on the registry. I felt confident.
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, I know we're just, Joseph and I right now, at least, we're just talking about Pennsylvania, but hopefully, you know, we can.
Yeah, we want to spread that whole progressiveness and mentality to every state we possibly can. And it starts like in rooms like this.
Yeah, and Joey and I are working on a thing that'll be a not just a Pennsylvania thing.
Good.
Yeah, it's
starting to really make some progress on it, so.
That's awesome.
I'm not allowed to say anything about it. I want to. I'm about to just turn my mic off and turn the camera off.
But I did buy plane tickets to go visit him in person.
Yeah.
About a month from now.
Yeah.
There you go. Well, I'm right there with you. But JB, please send me that email, though, so that I make sure that I got my notes right. I think.
Yeah. And before we forget, let's tell everybody how to save this chat. So JB, put your thing in the chat so that I can then, after I teach you how to save it, we won't lose what you just said. Anyway, what we're going to do, hopefully after JB puts whatever she asked him to put in there, we're going to go to the meeting chat, go to the three dots up at the top, and one of those dots in the three chat should say save chat. And when you do that, like for a second, it just disappears. But then after you close your screen, it just shows up. There we go. Board and care. Cool.
Yep. Great.
Okay. All right. Well, I really appreciate everyone coming. Do we have any more questions? Yep. Or comments. I know people have been dropping.
Thank you guys. I really appreciate and you inviting me tonight, and You all have my contact information. Please reach out to me.
And... We got a question, John.
Well, excuse me, not a question, but to both Joseph and Dr. Gerstad about this project, this simulation project. Please get in touch with me.
Yeah,
I will, John. I will, man. For Arkansas, I got you.
Yes.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right, John, you want to put your email in the chat?
I already
Please.
Did.
Oh, you already did? Okay. Excellent.
And send it to me. I don't see it. I don't know I what I did. It. I'm like, weird.
I didn't see your name. Look, I didn't see your name listed, so I sent it to Stephanie.
Yep, I got it.
Okay.
I'll send it to you, Joey. I'll just text it to you.
Yep.
All right. Thank you, everybody.
Thanks, everybody. Yeah, thank you.